There's an old Hasidish joke, which asks, why is the fast of the ninth of Av called Tisha B'Av? Right, which literally can mean the ninth by the father, by the Av, right? Of course, it's the ninth of the month of Av. But this Hasidish vort or joke asks, why is it called Tisha B'Av and not Tisha B'Ein? The ninth of the father and not the ninth of the mother. And the answer is because just as a father has no idea what his wife is going through, what the mother is going through during the Tisha Yarchei Leida, during the 9 months of pregnancy, all the difficulties and pain that she feels and discomfort that she experiences, so too, we have a hard time, just like a father does, relating to the pain and the suffering for the Churban HaBayit, the destruction of the Holy Temple, and the Churban Yerushalayim. And it's funny, because it's true. We do have a hard time relating to a Churban that took place almost 2,000 years ago. We have a hard time relating to the loss of a holy temple, something that we never saw, that we never experienced. And so that is the challenge, I think, in our day, how to experience Tisha B'Av, how to feel a real sense of loss, how to experience the mourning. And I think the challenge is maybe even more difficult for those of us living here in the land of Israel. Those of us fortunate to live here in Yerushalayim HaBenuya, in a rebuilt Jerusalem, a Jerusalem that is constantly being built, as we're seeing before our very eyes, right? Most mornings, I come here a few minutes late because I have to deal with all the traffic due to all the road work that's taking place in the city of Jerusalem. And wherever you look, there are cranes and there's construction sites. I mean, this entire country is one big construction site, especially Yerushalayim. Construction sites everywhere. So Yerushalayim is in a state of binya, of hitpatchut, of building and developing, and it's flourishing. So I think the challenge maybe is even more so for those of us living in a rebuilt Jerusalem. And so this morning, we begin a series of classes, a special summer series, on how we mourn the Churban in the rebuilt Jerusalem. And I'd like to take a look together with you this morning at a fascinating topic that really gives expression to this very tension, this very conflict. The special mitzvah of rending one's garment upon seeing the cities of Judah, the city of Jerusalem, and the Makom HaMikdash, the place where the Holy Temple stood, in a state of destruction. And we'll ask this morning, are these things indeed in a state of Churban? Is it still relevant? And we'll look at how the political reality impacts on this area of halacha. And it's fascinating how just over the last century there's been so much discussion and debate with regards to this very, very takana of our chazal. And so if you take a look here at source number one, this is a braita at the very top of Daf Chaf Vav Amud Aleph in Masechet Moed Katan. And the Braita begins as follows. Ve'elu kirein she'ein mitachim. These are the tears that one may not repair. Now the Gemara goes on to explain that they may be repaired in a crude way. They can be basted. But they can't be, let's say, professionally repaired. You can't bring them to your tailor to professionally repair. Hakorea al aviv v'al imo. Unfortunately, this is something that we're all familiar with. Someone who rends his garment upon the death of a parent, a father, or mother, right? As opposed to one of the other krovim, which may be repaired. For a father or mother, it is not permitted to repair that tear. Okay, there are other halachot related to tearing for a parent as well. All right, it might be basted, but it can't be fully repaired. V'al rabo shelimdo Torah, and for one's Rebbe Muvhok, one's Rebbe who taught him Rov Chochma, most of his wisdom, one who molded him and shaped him, his spiritual parent, so to speak, that tear also may not be permanently or professionally repaired, let's call it. Ve'al nasi ve'al avbeitin, the nasi and the avbeitin of the Sanhedrin, you might say the rebbes of all of Klal Yisrael, ve'al shmuot haraot, and upon hearing very bad news, devastating news, one rends their garment, ve'al birkat Hashem, and upon hearing someone curse God, that's what Birkat Hashem means. It's a euphemism for one who curses God. Val Sefer Torah Shenisraf, if one witnesses a Torah scroll being burned. And here, the next few lines, this is relevant to our conversation this morning. Val Arei Yehuda, Val Hamikdash, Val Yerushalayim. And upon seeing the cities of Judah in a state of Churban, the Mikdash, the place where the temple stood, or maybe the place where the temple is laying in ruin, when our sages lived and saw before the Temple Mount was plowed under, and they saw the ruins of the temple. Ve'al Yerushalayim, and upon Jerusalem. Ve'korei al Mikdash mosif al Yerushalayim. And the Braita there ends by saying that one who rends for the Mikdash, for the site where the temple stood, so then he adds for Yerushalayim. We'll see what that means, but it would seem that you have to tear your garment a little bit more. You add to the tear. Okay, depends what you see first, as we'll see in a moment. So then skip to the next section here where the Gemara asks for a scriptural source. Areyu daminalan, right? Where do we know, from where do we derive that you have to rend your garment for the cities of Judah? Now, it's interesting that the question is formulated that way, almost as if, yes, it's obvious that one would have to tear for Yerushalayim. It's obvious that one would have to tear their garment when seeing the Holy Temple in a state of Churban, destruction, in a state of ruin. But where do we learn from, what Pasuk teaches that you have to rend your garment when seeing the cities of Judah in ruin? Okay, it's interesting that that's the way the Gemara formulates the question, almost like a kal vachomer, because we'll see, it doesn't ask for a scriptural source, doesn't ask for a pasuk to teach us about the Makom HaMikdash or Yerushalayim. In any case, Areyu Daminalan, the Gemara asks, Tichtiv, and it brings a pasuk from Yirmiyahu Perek Mem Aleph, Jeremiah 41, Vayavou Anashim Mishchem Mishilo Mishomron. There were men who came from Shechem, from Shiloh, from the Shomron. So they're coming from the north, right? From the Shomron. Shmonim ish, 80 men. Migulchei zakan v'kurei v'gadim mitgodedim. They were clean-shaven. That's interesting. They had rent garments and they had cut their flesh. That's also interesting. So presumably they were mourning, but they cut their flesh, which is a prohibited expression of mourning from the Torah, as we know. So that's very interesting. And as we know that in the Shomron, that's, of course, we spoke about that not too long ago. That was Malchut Yisrael. Okay? And the people there were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, and they were not keeping Torah and Mitzvot. So that could explain why they had cut their flesh. But what's this business of that they were clean-shaven, yet their garments were torn? We'll see what that means in a moment. U'mincha uvona biyadam lavi beit Hashem. And they had offerings. They had a meal offering, and they had frankincense in their hands that they were going to bring to the house of Hashem. And these people had come from the north, and they were unaware that the Holy Temple had been destroyed. They brought korbanot with them. They brought a mincha, right? They brought a meal offering. They hadn't been informed that the Holy Temple had already been destroyed. It reminds me of something that I shared not too long ago, how a member of my shul was there when the first crop of olim from Ethiopia came. I guess it was Mifza Moshe, must have been Mifza Moshe. And, this was already after Mifza Achim, which was this covert operation that the Mossad had performed. But the first major airlift, Mifza Moshe, so he came and he helped with the people, he volunteered, bringing them from the airport, putting them on buses to Yerushalayim, taking them to the Kotel, and he told me how they began to weep and rend their garments when they heard that the Holy Temple had been destroyed. They didn't know. They were living in Ethiopia thinking they were coming to Jerusalem to the Holy Temple. It's incredible. So these people, they didn't know. They got to the Arei Yehuda. Okay, they saw that the Arei Yehuda, the cities of Judah, were destroyed, and they rent their garments. They tore their clothes as a sign of mourning. That explains why they were shaved, right? The pasuk says migulchei zakan. They were shaved because it was a fresh tear, meaning they just heard now. So they had shaved their beards previously because they hadn't heard, they hadn't begun to mourn. They get to the Arei Yehuda on their way to Yerushalayim, and then they tear their garments, right? That's why they have a clean shave, you know. Or maybe they had a 5 o'clock shadow, but okay. Then the Gemara continues. Amar Rabbi Chelbo, Amar Ula, Bira, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Haro'eh Arei Yehuda bechurbanan, Omer, Arei Kotshecha hayumidbar vekorea. One who sees the cities of Judah in a state of destruction, rends his garment, and says, your holy cities have become a wilderness. Yerushalayim b'churban, he sees the city of Jerusalem in a state of churban. Omer, he says, Tzion mibar haita Yerushalayim shmama v'korea. He says, Tzion has become a wilderness, Yerushalayim a wasteland, and rends. Beit hamikdash b'churbano, he sees the holy temple in a state of ruin. Omer, he says, Beit Kodshenu v'tifartenu asher hiluchavu tenu haya lisrefat esh v'kol machmadenu haya l'chorba v'korea. He says, the temple of our holiness and our splendor where our fathers praised you has become a fiery conflagration. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Conflagration. And all that we desired has become a ruin, and then he rends his garment. Okay? So you say this pasuk, and then you rend. And then the Gemara goes back to that statement that we saw on the Braita. Koreo Migdash Musif al Yerushalayim. One tears for the Beit HaMikdash, and then he adds a little bit for Yerushalayim. Ureminu. And the Gemara says, well, wait a minute. We have a contradictory statement in another Braita. Echad Oshomea, right? We have a Braita that says, whether one hears about it, Echad Oroe, or he sees the ruins, right? Kevan Shegil at Tzofim Korea. When he gets to Tzofim, now, it's a machloket rishonim, whether Tzofim refers to a place where, like an outlook where you can see Yerushalayim, or maybe a specific place, maybe a village, maybe Har HaTzofim, right? There's a place where you see the Holy Temple. The Korea al Mikdash Bifnei Atzmo, and he tears for the Holy Temple by itself, meaning he makes one tear in his garment. The al Yerushalayim Bifnei Atzma, and then he makes another tear. In other words, he doesn't add. So this is interesting. The Gemara is asking a kasha. The Gemara is challenging that braita that suggested that when one sees Yerushalayim, he only adds to the tear. Here, this braita says that one makes a separate tear. Okay? And the Gemara answers, lo kasha. No, no, no. It's not a question. It's not a challenge. There is no conflict. Ha depaga b'mikdash v'reisha. Ha depaga b'Yerushalayim bereisha. In one case, we're saying he came to the Beit HaMikdash first. In which case, when he came to the Beit HaMikdash first, right? So then he makes a full tear. And then, when he sees Yerushalayim in a state of Qurban, so then he only has to add to it. Right? That's what it means, mosif. Because the Beit HaMikdash has a greater status, you can imagine, right? So he sees the Makom HaMikdash, the place where the temple stood, in a state of ruin, so he makes a full tear, then he sees Yerushalayim. So how would that be? Normally you visit Yerushalayim first. So some explain. Maybe he sees it from, again, this outlook point, that's what it means, or he sees, you know, he's traveling in a certain way, or maybe he's in some sort of agala. There are different explanations, but this is sort of beyond the scope of our discussion this morning. I don't want to get too much into it. I don't want to get lost in different opinions in the Rishonim, how they read this Gemara. But in any case, if you see the Makom HaMikdash first, you make a complete tear, and then you see Yerushalayim, you make just an addition. However, when we say that it requires, in this Braita, two full tears, that's in a case where you see Yerushalayim first. Okay? You see Yerushalayim in a state of ruin, you make a full tear, then you come to the Makom HaMikdash. Well, that warrants its own full tear. Okay, all right. Instead, we'll revisit this in a few moments. But of course, the question is, how do we define Churban? How do we define Churban? That goes to the heart of our discussion this morning, right? We said, you know, here we have this mitzvah. Here we have this takana. Our rabbis decreed that when you see the cities of Judah, the city of Yerushalayim, the place where the Holy Temple stood, when you see those sites in a state of ruin, you rend your garment. Well, are they in ruin today? I mean, that's the question. That's the question. I once spoke about this somewhere, and someone in the audience was from Har Nof, and they know that I live in Har Nof, and they asked me, Rabbi, is Har Nof in a state of ruin? I said, if you come into my house, right? It's all a matter of perspective. But today, Yerushalayim is not in a state of ruin. With over 500,000 Jewish residents, think about it, over 500,000 Jewish residents in Yerushalayim, and I'm including not just the old city or Yerushalayim Mekudeshet, I'm including, you know, modern Jerusalem as well. But with over 500,000 Jewish residents, Yerushalayim today is teeming with life. Her skies lined with new buildings. Every time I come back from a trip, I just came back the other day from a trip abroad, I always see some new building going up, okay, in the taxi. Well, now I take a train, but in the hasa'ah, the nesher, or a taxi, I say, when did that building go up, right? Right, the traffic, again, road work because of the light rail expansions and buildings going up, and there's traffic everywhere. I mean, we waited for 2,000 years and hoped and prayed to be able to sit in traffic in the holy streets of Jerusalem. But the city's growing by leaps and bounds. You know, we say Yerushalayim, you're right, Yerushalayim tet vav. Tibaneve tikonein. I mean, we're witnessing tavvav. Yeah, thank you. Tavvav. Yerushalayim tibaneve tikonein. We're witnessing a rebuilding of Jerusalem in our own days. I mean, it's incredible. You can't help but feel that we're witnessing the fulfillment of the prophecy of Zechariah, that old men and women will once again sit in the streets of Yerushalayim, and boys and girls play in her streets, right? I think if Zechariah was living today, he'd have to add a pasuk that, I'm sorry? Thank you. Zechariah would have to add a pasuk today that retirees will come and study at the OU Israel Center. And not just retirees. Okay, I'm going to interrupt for a moment. I've been asked to announce that the entire morning of Shiurim today are dedicated in loving memory of Mrs. Charlotte Brachfeld, Alea Shalom, Marat Shendel Leah Bat Reb Shimshon, Shimon, excuse me, Bat Reb Shimon, Alea Shalom, on the occasion of her first Yeretzeit. Okay, thank you for reminding me. I apologize for not making that announcement earlier. Shetehei Nishmatat Sura Bitzor HaChayim. Okay, so, and we'll see together this morning that following the miraculous birth of the state of Israel and the dramatic reclamation of Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount during the Six-Day War, those monumental days, those miraculous days of June 1967, the question of Kriya for the Churban became the subject of much discussion and debate among poskim. Here we are, we've returned to our land. Should we still rend our garment? Right? Here we are. We have a unified Yerushalayim. Har Habayit Biyadenu, the famous battle cry of Mata Gur. Is it still relevant to rend one's garment as a sign of mourning when there's maybe no reason to mourn anymore? So again, we have to define what Churban is. How do we define Churban? And then we'll see that later, following the Oslo Accords and the disengagement, once again, Poskim would debate the status of the territories under the Palestinian Authority and whether or not, all of a sudden, maybe Kriya is warranted once again. Maybe while these places were under Israeli sovereignty, there was no reason to rend one's garment, but once the administration has been given over to the Palestinian Authority, right? Once there's no longer Jewish sovereignty there, then maybe it is relevant again to rend one's garment. So at the heart of the machloket is, again, how we define churban and how the political reality impacts on this halacha. And as I said, this is a fascinating discussion which really expresses this very tension of this time that we live today. Right? We've come so far, but yet we still have a ways to go. Okay, so how do we define churban? Right? That's really the question. So we've mentioned many times here in our classes together, Ishtori HaParchi and his work, Kaftor Vaferach. He's a fascinating individual who lived in the 13th century into the 14th century, and according to some, he came from France, but the family had come from Spain. His name was Ishtori HaParchi. There are different explanations for it, but that really just a pen name. He's assumed to be Rav Yitzchak HaKohen ben Rav Moshe HaParchi. Okay, his Ishtori HaParchi is just a pen name. Some explain it to mean Ish Torah. He was a man of Torah. However, there are other definitions and explanations of that first name. And HaParchi, because the family is believed to have come from Florencia, Spain. Right? Florencia, flower, perach, parchi. Okay, they're all different interpretations. And there's a lot of controversy surrounding his life, but eventually he makes his way to Eretz Yisrael, just a fascinating individual, and writes this very, very important work on the geography of Eretz Yisrael. Right, his Kaftor Vaferach defines Israel's borders, which is so important with regard to the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz. And he deals with the mitzvot hatliot ba'aretz, many mitzvot related to the land of Israel, agricultural laws. Very, very important work, Kaftor Vaferach. It always bothers me that here in Yerushalayim, there's a street that's named for him, but it's this tiny, tiny little simta, a tiny little alley that you would miss. It's in Geula. And you would miss it if not for the fact that there's like a little miuchedet clinic there, which I once took my wife to for an ultrasound before one of our children was born. Okay, but it always bothers me. Here's this, such an important individual I'm always quoting in classes, and all he gets is this tiny little alleyway. Okay, but at least he's got something in Yerushalayim. So he defines churban as the absence of Jewish settlement. There's no yeshuv, right? That's called churban. Should an area be settled, according to the Kaftor Vaferach, one would be exempt from rending his garment. Okay. However, we'll see that while the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, cites this explanation or definition, really, of what churban is for our purposes this morning, ultimately he concludes and defines churban as subjugation under foreign rule, meaning an absence of Jewish sovereignty. It's Jewish sovereignty, according to the Beit Yosef, that determines whether an area is to be considered in a state of churban or not, and whether one must rent his garment. So take a look here at source number two. Right. Here, the Beit Yosef writes, V'hai arei Yehuda bechurbanan. Right. What does it mean? De'ka'amar dehainu shehen charevot, ve'ein bahen yishuv klal. It means that they are desolate. They are laid in ruin, and there's no yeshuv. There's no settlement. Aval im yesh bahen yeshuv, af al pi shehen bidei goyim, haya nir'e lichora, de'ein tzerich likra'a. Right? But if there is Jewish settlement, there's Jewish life there, so then even if they are under a foreign rule, that would obviate the need to rend one's garment. So think, you know, throughout Jewish history, whether that's, you know, the Romans, okay, or the, fast forward, the Ottomans, or the British, even if these cities, the cities of Judah, Jerusalem, are in foreign hands, okay, but since there's Jewish settlement, Jews living there, there's Jewish life there, that would obviate the need to rend one's garment. And then he continues, V'efshar, dekol shehen bidei goyim, afal pi sheish behen yeshuv, bechurbanan mikre. Well, you know what, although, however, maybe it's possible that even if there's Jewish life there, even if Jews are living there, maybe even if there's a Jewish majority, since it is in the hands of the Gentiles, meaning there is no Jewish sovereignty, it's under foreign control, then it would still be called churban, it would be called ruin, and it would require one to rend his garment. V'chein ikar, and that is the ikar. That is how we paskin, and many, many achronim accept this latter definition of churban. The Bach and the Magen Avram and the Mishnah Brura and the Patash Shulchan and many, many others, the Kaf HaChayim, many adopt this explanation of what churban is, that churban means a lack of Jewish sovereignty. So then, of course, the question becomes, what if we have Jewish sovereignty? Then maybe we no longer have to rend our garment as an expression of mourning, because these cities, these places are in Jewish hands. And then, of course, what about the Makom HaMikdash? Is it enough just to have sovereignty over the Temple Mount? Or by the fact that, no, the Holy Temple is destroyed. What do you mean? We can't stop mourning. Of course we must rend. So that really, again, is the heart of our discussion this morning. Okay? So first of all, there are different explanations of why the cities of Yehudah. Of course, the cities of Yehudah have a special status. The Bach says they're more important than other cities. The Levush explains because of their proximity to Yerushalayim. The Patash Shulchan, who was one of the Talmidim of the Gaon Mivilna, who comes on Aliyah and also writes a very important work on the laws of the land of Israel, the agricultural laws, and other things as well. And he talks about this, rending one's garment. He explains that the cities of Judah, the Arei Yehudah, have a unique status as the seat of the monarchy, of Malchut Beit David. And that explanation works very well with the Beit Yosef's definition of what churban is. Because if churban is a lack of Jewish sovereignty, so then yeah, it makes sense to tear when seeing the cities of Judah in a state of churban, because they represent sovereignty. They represent Malchut Beit David. They represent the seat of the monarchy. Okay? So it's this explanation of the Patash Shulchan only reinforces that it is indeed Jewish sovereignty, or really the lack thereof, which defines churban. Now, historically, rending one's garment for the Arei Yehudah and even Yerushalayim fell out of practice. And you see a number of sources discuss this, the Radbaz, and some Tshuvot in the Birkei Yosef and the Shari Tshuva, and then more contemporary poskim like the Mishnah Halachot and the Divrei Yoel and the Divrei Yitziv, the Alichot Shlomo, Rosh Shlomo, Zalman Auerbach will come back to in a little bit, the Tshuvot van Hagot of Rav Moshe Sternbuch, and my neighbor in Harnof, not my literal neighbor, but he lives in Harnof. But take a look here at source number 6. This is from a very important sefer called Ir HaKodesh HaMikdash from Yechiel Michal Tukochinsky. It was a major, major Talmud Chacham and Posek, of course, he wrote the Sefer Gesher HaChayim on the laws of mourning. Okay, so he explains here in source number 6. I'm just going to summarize it for the sake of time. But he offers two defenses for the laxity in observance of tearing for the Arei Yehudah. First, he writes that the identity and the exact location of the ancient cities of Judah is not so clear today. And he writes this also in his Sefer Eretz Yisrael, and other sources deal with this as well. A lot of poskim discuss this, but you know, today's Beit Lechem, for instance, right? Beit Lechem is certainly one of the cities of Yehudah, but right? Do we know exactly where it is? Well, there were actually two Beit Lechems that we do know. There was one in the north and one in the south, but the Beit Lechem that was Beit Lechem Yehudah, right? Let's say the Beit Lechem that is where Kever Rachel is today. Exactly where that ancient city sat, do we really know? So again, some of these sites have been excavated and maybe we know, others less so, but because of, let's say, a lack of clarity, so it kind of fell out of practice, according to some. Okay? And that's the first defense that Rav Yechiel Michal Tukochinsky writes. For instance, it's a whole discussion by Chevron. Was Chevron, certainly we know where, let's say, the ancient city of Chevron was, because we have the Marat HaMachpelah there, right? So, but there's a question, was Chevron one of the Arei Yehudah or not? or does it have a different status because it was an ir miklat? Again, the poskim discuss that. I don't want to get lost. But secondly, Rav Yechiel Michal Tukuchinsky says that most of those who would travel to the land of Israel, at least in his day, would arrive at one of the ports, whether it was Yafo or Haifa, and then they would typically, he writes, travel to Yerushalayim before visiting the cities of Yehuda. And once one has already performed Kriyaf Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim has a greater status, and Yerushalayim, of course, is one of the cities of Yehuda, right? I mean, Yerushalayim and the Beit HaMikdash wasn't divided up among the Shvatim, but let's say Yerushalayim is to be considered one of the Arei Yehuda. So, and you know, more important than the others, just like we mentioned that Makom HaMikdash, right, has a greater status than Yerushalayim. So he assumes that that's why it fell out of practice, because people would come, just like today, a lot of people, you know, I don't know how many tourists do this, but I certainly know that a lot of groups, you bring like an NCSY group. Here we are at the OU Center. So let's say NCSY. I was a number of times a madrich on an NCSY summer program for teens here in Israel, from teens from North America, right? David here in the back also was involved in NCSY in New Jersey. That's where we met. So you take the kids right from Ben-Gurion Airport, right on the bus to the Kotel, right? That's what you do first, right? You want to inspire them. You want to... So that's what he says. People would go and they would end up, would disembark in one of the port cities like Yafo or Haifa, and then go make their way to Yerushalayim and pass by the cities of Judah. And once you performed Kriya for Yerushalayim, you no longer have to rend again. You're exempt. Okay? Now, following the Hakamat HaMedina, the miraculous birth of the state of Israel, a number of poskim ruled that it's no longer required to rend one's garment when seeing the Arei Yehuda, right? Because the Arei Yehuda are part of the state of Israel. Okay, maybe some of them were following the Hakamat Medina, were under Jordanian control, okay? Following the war. So you could say at that point, right, they were no longer under Jewish sovereignty. But with the declaration of Israel's independence, those cities, the cities of Judah, are all of a sudden under Jewish sovereignty for the first time in, you know, almost 2,000 years. And so there was a machloket among the poskim, right? Some questioned whether a secular state not governed by Jewish law should be considered Jewish sovereignty. That, of course, was the Divrei Yoel, the Satmar Rav, and many other poskim, the Be'er Moshe, even the Lubavitcher Rebbe, many, many others questioned whether that is called Jewish sovereignty. Here it is, this secular state that was founded by, you know, secular Zionists. Okay. Now, it became a moot point, as I mentioned, with the Jordanian control. The controversy would remain dormant for another 19 years, as Judea, these cities of Judah, were captured and remained under Jordanian control until June 1967. But after the Six-Day War, all of a sudden, this question became relevant again. And many poskim ruled that it is no longer necessary to perform kriya upon city, seeing the cities of Judah, as now they were under Jewish sovereignty. Okay, we'll see. We'll take a look now at a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, here in source number 6. Okay, this is a tshuva
recording
that was
in progress.
Tufshin Mem Aleph, which is what, 1981. But he had already paskined previously with regards to the Arei Yehuda and with Yerushalayim, but here he's writing this tshuva to his grandson, Rav Mordechai Tendler. And he writes, look where I've underlined, Ach, mesik, the ikar de kol shem bidei akum afal pi sheyesh behem yishuv bechurbanan mikre. He adopts the definition of the Beit Yosef that churban is a lack of Jewish sovereignty. V'chein katvu ha-taz magen Avram, the taz magen Avram. I said many poskim, the Bach and the Mishneh Berurah. Pirush ha-magen Avram inyan ze biyoter shekatav afal pi sheyoshvim behem Yisrael kevan shu moshlim aleihem mikre churban. He says even though the places are settled by Jews. Nevertheless, if they're under foreign rule, they're called Chorban. U'kilashon HaMagen Avram katam gam b'Mishneh Berurah. The Mishneh Berurah also adopts this definition of the Magen Avram. She'im keinata shebechasdei Hashem Yitbarach. So if so, if Chorban is defined as a lack of Jewish sovereignty, then im kein ata now shebechasdei Hashem Yitbarach, with great kindness to God, right? In God's great kindness, ein moshlima umot al are Yehuda v'al Yerushalayim. Again, writing in 1981, now that Yerushalayim and the cities of Judah are under Jewish sovereignty, v'hem gam yushavim, and they're also settled, hutam gadol shelo likroa. This is a very big reason, okay, very compelling. I'll translate it as compelling. Very compelling reason not to tear one's garment. Af shadayin lo ba'gula al yidei melech ha-mashiach. Ve'anu mit pachadim me'ahumot ein likroa. Even though we're still waiting for the final redemption, even though the melech ha-mashiach has not come, the Messiah has not come, and there's still a security situation. We're still afraid from the surrounding nations. Okay, there's a concern for our security, both from without and within. Right, things are far from perfect, and you see, by the way, that a number of poskim, like Rav Avadi Yosef, and we've seen examples of this in the past, and a number of different tshuvot that we've looked at from contemporary poskim that are dealing with these issues, you know, of this new reality of Jewish sovereignty in our land. Sometimes they take into the cheshbon, they take into consideration the security threat, they take into consideration the fact that they're, you know, is a constant threat of war. They take into consideration sometimes the spiritual status of the state of Israel, the spiritual state of the state of Israel. But for Rav Moshe, by the fact that the Arei Yehuda and Yerushalayim are in Jewish hands, that we've restored Jewish sovereignty, we no longer need to rend our garment. But what about the Makom HaMikdash? He writes, Aval kishroe Makom HaMikdash, Shadayin, simply put, since the place of the temple is still in a state of churban and will only be built, this is according to his opinion, there are different opinions, I don't want to get lost this morning, different opinions how the temple will be built, but at least the way Rav Moshe understands that the temple will be rebuilt by the Mashiach. So it's very simple, according to Rav Moshe, that for the Makom HaMikdash, when one sees the site of the temple, one still has to rend their garment. He doesn't adopt the definition of Jewish sovereignty or a lack of Jewish sovereignty for the Temple Mount. And the truth is, if you look very closely at the Lashon, the language of the Beit Yosef, and we'll see, this is maybe the Nekudat HaMachloket among contemporary poskim, whether one needs to rend their garment for the Makom HaMikdash. The Beit Yosef defines Churban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty vis-a-vis the Arei Yehuda and Yerushalayim. Okay? He doesn't really deal with the site of the Holy Temple. It's possible to suggest that, just like Rav Moshe, the Beit Yosef also assumes that until there's a temple standing there, you still have to rend. Whether or not the temple is in Jewish hands or not, or whether or not the Temple Mount is under Jewish control, Jewish sovereignty. We'll come back to that point in a moment. Okay? But according to Rav Moshe, you no longer have to rend for the Arei Yehuda or for Yerushalayim. Okay? This is a very important tshuva. Rav Moshe looks at the political reality, this new reality of Jewish sovereignty in our land. It's incredible, and how that impacts on the halacha. And it wasn't just Rav Moshe, but many, many poskim, many authorities believe that following the Six-Day War, one is no longer obligated to rend his garment for the Arei Yehuda and for Yerushalayim. Okay? So you have poskim, for instance, like the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg, the Minchat Shlomo of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which we'll come to in a moment with regards to Yerushalayim, but as far as Arei Yehuda, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach felt that one no longer has to rend for the Arei Yehuda, Okay, Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, and Rav Chaim David Halevi, and Rav Avad Yosef, and Rav Moshe Sternbuch. Many, many contemporary poskim feel that nowadays one no longer has to rent for the Arei Yehuda. But what about Yerushalayim? So we saw right now that according to Rav Moshe, right, since Jewish sovereignty has been restored to Yerushalayim due to Hashem's great kindnesses, there's no longer a reason to rend, and that's how many felt. Okay, and not just Rav Moshe, but many, many poskim. Okay, however, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach disagreed, and here, if you take a look at source number 7, this is from the Minchat Shlomo, just a small section of the Tshuva there in Chelek Aleph Siman Ayin Gimel. Here in source number 7, on the next page at the top, he writes the following. Choshevani de kol zman sheroim adayin b'ir hakodesh v'mikdash knesiot shel nochrim v'gam kivrei akum. He says, all the while, when in Jerusalem, the holy city, there are churches and places of worship that belong to other religions and Gentile graves, v'ein anu yicholim l'ma'aker puchana nuchra'a. And we cannot uproot this foreign worship, this foreign culture, adayin hi b'chorbana. It's still considered korban. So he doesn't adopt a lack of Jewish sovereignty as the definition for korban. By Arei Yehuda he does, but with regards to Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, the holy city, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach looks at the spiritual state, the current spiritual state of our holy city. And if there's still foreign influence and foreign culture and worship, that's called korban. V'ata, and now, einenu nisuot l'shamayim, our eyes turn heavenward, they're directed heavenward, lirota meheira b'pulchana dishmaya b'vinan beit ha-bechira, v'nagila b'ashem minismecha b'yishuato l'netzach. And he says that our eyes are turned heavenward, and we hope to see the restoration of the heavenly worship, pulchana dishmaya, heavenly culture, heavenly worship, Torah, mitzvot, and the restoration of the Holy Temple, Hashem's chosen house, and then we will truly celebrate and rejoice with the salvation for eternity. Okay, that's how he ends this tshuva. However, again, many, many contemporary poskim felt that for Yerushalayim, one no longer has to rend his garment. However, there were those like Rav Sraya Diblitsky, who felt that even the status of Yerushalayim is dependent on the Makom HaMikdash. And this is something that you find also Rav Soloveitchik spoke about. Some extend the Makom HaMikdash to include Yerushalayim with regards to this mitzvah, or this takana of Chazal, this institution as an expression of mourning. Rav Yaakov Ariel from Ramat Gan has a whole discussion on this in his Be'ohala Shel Torah, in the second chelek, the second volume of his Tshuvot. But Rav Sraya Diblitsky, who passed away not too long ago, he was a major, major Talmud Chacham, lived in Bnei Brak, wrote many, many Tshuvot, many, many Sfarim, and he wrote on a lot of these issues with regards to contemporary issues with state. You know, I don't want to say church and state, but Medina and Halacha, right? Okay. So he ruled that no, if there's no Beit HaMikdash, so then Yerushalayim too is in a state of Korban and one should be stringent and rent his garment. And Rav Soloveitchik had a famous approach. It's really based on the Rambam. The Rambam in a number of places in his Perush HaMishnah extends the concept of the Mikdash to include Yerushalayim as well, Yerushalayim HaMikudeshet. And there are a number of examples. I don't want to get lost, but Rav Soloveitchik too felt that if the Makom HaMikdash is in a state of Churban, then Yerushalayim also is in a state of Churban. Okay, and then one should rend. However, his Talmud Muvhak, Rav Schechter from YU, explained that the minog really is not to rend. Even though, Rav Soloveitchik felt that one should rend, okay, when seeing Yerushalayim, because again, the Kedusha of the Mikdash is extended to Yerushalayim. The Rambam defines Mikdash as including Yerushalayim. Nevertheless, Rav Shechter said that's not the minhag, because typically we follow the lenient opinion in matters of mourning. Halacha kidivrei hamekil be'evel, okay, or ba'avel. That's the general klal, the general principle. He writes this in his Sefer Bikvei Hatzon. Okay, it's also Moshe Sternbach has a tshuva in Moadim Uzmanim and his tshuvot v'hanhagot. In any case, that's with regards to Yerushalayim. What about the Makom HaMikdash? I mentioned Matagur's famous battle cry, Har HaBayit Biyadenu, which is forever etched into our collective consciousness. Okay? The imagery of those fateful days in 1967 still resonates with us today. So the question, of course, arose following those famous words, Har HaBayit Biyadenu, whether to rend or not when visiting the Temple Mount. So we saw how, according to Rav Moshe, one would still rend upon seeing the Beit HaMikdash, the place where the Beit HaMikdash stood, the Makom HaMikdash, right? Because without a temple there, it doesn't matter if it's in Jewish hands or not. It doesn't matter if Har HaBayit Biyadenu or not. Okay? Now, the truth is today, you can put a question mark there, right? Is indeed Har HaBayit Biyadenu? Har HaBayit Biyadenu? I mean, very quickly, the administration had been given over to the Waqf. In fact, there's a whole debate as to the opinion of Rav Tzvi Yehuda HaKohen Kuk, whether or not, you know, he initially said, he issued a ruling in the religious Zionist newspaper Hatzofeh. Hatzofeh was kind of a precursor to the Makor Rishon. And Hatzofeh, very, very important religious Zionist newspaper, a lot of important discussions and debates among the poskim on these very issues, right? These very important issues following the Six-Day War. I've gone through a lot of the microfilm of old issues of the Hatzofeh in the National
Recording
Library.
Recording in progress.
So Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Shlomo Goren, they initially said, one does not have to rend following the Six-Day War when seeing the Temple Mount, because Har HaBayit Biyadenu, it's in our hands. But when that initial euphoria of those early days in June 1967 gave way to a stark reality, Rav Goren ultimately retracted his ruling, as administration of the site was given over to the Waqf. And again, if we are defining Churban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty here, if they give the keys over the Waqf, maybe there's no longer Jewish sovereignty, even though it's in the state of Israel, even though Israel formally annexed Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. Okay, but in any case, there's a debate among the Talmidim of Rav Tzvi Yehuda whether he too retracted his ruling or not. Of other poskim, contemporary poskim like Rav Avadia Hedayin, Yaskil Avdi, he said that even if you had true sovereignty, you'd still have to rend. Why? Because you can't enter into the Temple Mount, or at least certain parts of it. Let's say the Azara, and then Midrabanan, the Chael, whatever. You can't enter it without the ashes of the red heifer, right? We are impure, we are tmeim, and we won't have a red heifer. There's this idea that the red heifer is associated with the coming of the Mashiach. So he felt that it's still not called sovereignty. For him, political sovereignty isn't enough. You need spiritual sovereignty, which is impossible without the Mashiach and the red heifer when we are all in a state of impurity. And Rav Chaim David Halevi, also a very important posek, he wrote, theoretically, maybe one should not rend when seeing the Makom HaMikdash, but the matter awaits a formal decision by the chief rabbinate, so he didn't want to paskin, and the chief rabbinate never really paskined on this issue, although we'll see a very interesting tshuva in a moment from Rav Mordechai Fogelman. But in any case, as I said, you know, with regards to the Har HaBayit, Machloket HaPoskim, I'd say most of the poskim feel, and this is the real consensus, and this is real the real minhag, right? Most of the poskim feel that one should rend the garment if one sees the Temple Mount, one sees Har HaBayit, after not having seen it in 30 days, one should rend his garment. There are all sorts of trikim and shtikim that the poskim, like Rav Moshe, doesn't really like. People like switch shirts with someone because the halacha is, if you hear, God forbid, the news of a relative that passes away and you're wearing someone else's shirt, you don't have to rend the garment because it doesn't belong to you. So they switch shirts. They say, here, my shirt is yours, your shirt is mine. Or sometimes they go on an Erev Shabbat, or they go on Chol HaMoed, and they say, well, you know, that obviates the need because you don't rend. Well, you don't mourn, you don't eulogize, but you actually would still rend. So you know, the poskim don't like this, these trickim and shtickim. But in any case, the consensus among the contemporary poskim is that the Temple Mount is still considered, or the Beit HaMikdash is still considered in a state of ruin, and therefore one would rend their garment when seeing the Makom HaMikdash. Okay. But take a look here at source number 8. This is a fascinating tshuva, really a beautiful tshuva that expresses this very tension. This is such a moving description. Okay, such a moving description by Rav Mordechai Fogelman, who lived from 1898 to 1984. He was a Rav in Poland before coming to Israel and becoming a Rav of Kiryat Motzkin. He was the chief rabbi of Kiryat Motzkin and a member of the Council of the Chief Rabbinate. Okay, so he was a member of the Moetzet HaRabbanut HaRoshit, a very important Rav, and he writes the following, where I've underlined. B'yom Zayin B'Sivan Tafshin Chav Zayin. So look when he writes this. He's relating this description in this tshuva here, in the first chelek of his tshuvot Beit Mordechai. He's relating a story that took place on the 7th of Sivan Tafshin Chav Zayin. Okay? This is the day after Shavuot, right? So this is Isru Chag Shavuot, Tafshin Chav Zayin, 1967. This is Yamim Sfurim, just a few days, really like 1 week, right? What, a little more, right? A week and a half from Yom Yerusha, from when Jerusalem was united, from when Har HaBayit was reclaimed, and the rabbis got together. Betom Kenes HaRabbanim HaArtzi BeHeichal Shlomo BeYerushalayim. This was at the conclusion of a rabbinic conference in Heichal Shlomo here in Jerusalem, which was the office of the chief rabbinate. Bikarti Yachad Im Kama Rabbanim Etzel HaKotel HaMaravi HaMishuchrar. So all of a sudden, there's this rabbinic conference in Jerusalem. So what are they going to do after? They're going to go to the Kotel. So they went to the newly freed Kotel, together with other rabbis. Mishalo ra'a et ha-simcha etzel ha-kotel, lo ra'a simcha miyamav. One who didn't see joy at the Kotel at this time has never seen joy in all of his days. Right? He's paraphrasing the famous Mishnah in Masechet Sukkah about the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, of course. Right? And he writes, Alafim naharu el ha-kotel, upneim zaru, michedva v'gil hitpalu b'lahat v'simcha v'odu l'adon ha-niflot. People, so many thousands were there and their faces were aglow and they were davening with a tremendous, tremendous fire and joy to Hashem. Bein ha-chogim ha-nilhavim hayu harbei shakaru kriya k'dina degmara. Right? And he said there were many there that, even though they were so happy and joyous, they rent their garment, as it says in the Gemara that we began with, right? And he says, I'm just skipping a line, Biroti zot, peniti libnei leviati v'amarti. So when I saw this, I turned to those who were with me, the rabbis that were with me, and I said, Achshav achrei anitzachon al oyvenu v'tzareinu, shema'atim kmoto b'divrei yimei amenu. ואחרי שחרורה של ירושלים העתיקה ובא מקום המקדש והכותל המערבי, אין לקרוא עוד בביקורנו אצל הכותל, אלא לברך ברכת שהחיינו בשם ומלכות. He said, it doesn't make sense here. After all we've been through, after all we've gone through, and having witnessed this incredible miracle, we shouldn't rend our garment. Instead, we should say the bracha of Shechianu with God's name, בשם ומלכות. אמרתי ועשיתי מעשה. He says, I said this and I did this. Amarti vasitma. I didn't rend my garment. Instead, I made the brach of Shechianu b'shemu v'alchut. Amarti zot be'ofen spontani. He says, at the time, I said this in a spontaneous way. L'lo hachanot mukdamot. Without proper preparation. In other words, I didn't really think about it.
Bigala simcha ha'ilait shafafa otanu biroteinu et hakotel. Due to the great wave of joy, this exalted joy that took us over when we saw the kotel. Hasarid ha'yichidi shel beit hamikdash, the last remnant of the holy temple. Hamshuchrar midei zarim sheshaltu bo ke'elef v'teisha me'ot shana, which has been freed now from the hands of the Gentiles who had it for almost 2,000 years. Ho'il v'yishnam tamidei chachamim ha'korim kriya b'bikuram kayom etzel hakotel. However, there are those, the tamidei chachamim, major poskim, who say even today that the Temple Mount is under Jewish sovereignty, one should still rend, and that's what they do. Amarti, so I said to myself, "Et levarer et davar lufi hamikorot b'halacha b'talmud poskim rishonim v'achronim." Initially, he said, "My reaction was just spontaneous out of tremendous emotion." But then I went back and I revisited the sources. I revisited the sources. The sources in the halacha, the Talmud, the Gemara, the poskim, the rishonim, the achronim. And turn the page. Take a look where I've underlined next, right? And basically, he came to the conclusion that since, as we said, we define Qurban as a lack of Jewish sovereignty, and sovereignty has been restored, right? There's no reason to rend. Lefi zeh, anu ba'im lidei maskana yishira, ki im ein chiyuv od likroa al arei Yehuda, gam al Yerushalayim u'beit hamikdash. So he adopts, unlike Rav Moshe, he adopts the issue of sovereignty as the definition of Qurban vis-a-vis the Temple Mount as well, which, as I said, many posts can feel that, no, while you might say that sovereignty defines Churban, or a lack of sovereignty defines Churban vis-a-vis the Arei Yehuda and Yerushalayim, the Makom HaMikdash has a separate status, but he defines it there as well. He says there's no longer Chiyuv, Ein Od Chiyuv Likroa, there's no longer a reason to rend, now that it's in Jewish hands, under Jewish sovereignty. Okay, after this Tshuah Gdolah, She'asat Tzur Yisrael Amo Yisrael, after this incredible salvation that Hashem, the Rock of Israel, has done for his people, la'artso v'nachlato, and for his land and his inheritance, or their inheritance, right? Right, right. So that's Soloveitchik and Rosrei Deblitsky, and he writes that one who does rend, this is Harif, one who does rend, right, which is an expression of mourning, hem kfuye tova. Someone who rends today, right? They're kafui tov. They are, how would you define, what's a good definition? They're not giving proper thanks to Hashem. They are ungrateful. They're ungrateful. It's a lack of gratitude. They're ungrateful to what Hashem has done, these miracles and wonders that he's done for his chosen people and for his land, the land that he constantly seeks after. Okay? So then he concludes, look where I've underlined next. Ein makom bishat simcha ilait kazot shezachinu la'acharei alpayim shana shel churban galut v'shoa la'arbev et tuga v'et ha'evel l'toch ha'simcha sheyachad im birkat shechianu nikra kriya al churban beit ha'migdash. It says, you know, after all that we've been through, 2,000 years of exile and Shoah and destruction and Holocaust, how can you conflate and mix up the incredible joy that we feel now with an expression of mourning? Rending one's garment is an expression of mourning. It's inappropriate. Instead, he says, you have to say Shehachiyanu. Okay? You have to say Shehachiyanu. Incredible tshuva. But again, most contemporary authorities did not agree with this approach and felt that, no, it's not an issue of sovereignty, at least when it comes to the Makom HaMikdash. Yes, with Arei Yehuda, yes, with Yerushalayim. So what's interesting is, following the Six-Day War, Rav Shlomo Goren questioned if the cities of Yehuda can be considered under Jewish sovereignty, as they were never formally annexed by the State of Israel, right? Yehuda and Shomron were never formally annexed. Instead, Israel implemented civil administration there. But how do you define Jewish sovereignty, right? Interesting how the political reality impacts on the halakha here. He concluded, however, that even though Israeli law, formal Israeli law, is not imposed on those areas, Israel's military rule suffices as sovereignty in this regard. So at least with the Arei Yehuda, right? But what about the Oslo Accords? So that changed everything. And all of a sudden, you have areas A, B, and C. And, you know, if you pass Beit Lechem today, there's a big red sign that says that it's prohibited for Israeli citizens to enter. Okay? And so, yeah, a number of contemporary poskim like Rav Schechter, we mentioned already this morning, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Nevinsal from the old city, Rav Dov Lior, felt that, yeah, post-Oslo, these Arei Yehuda, which we said, all the poskim said, that post-Six-Day War, you no longer have to rend for the Arei Yehuda, because it's Jewish sovereignty. Well, post-Oslo, Area A, right, it's no longer... No, Area A lacks Jewish sovereignty. Area A is under full Palestinian authorities' control. There's no longer Jewish sovereignty there. So you have poskim that like Rav Schechter, Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Nevinsal, Rav Dov Lior, ruled that these cities are no longer under Jewish sovereignty, and one has to rend. Okay, one has to rend. Rav Eliyahu Bakshi Daron was Mekil. He fell, you know, he actually addressed Beit Lechem. He said, Beit Lechem is no longer post-Oslo under Jewish sovereignty, right, since it's administered by the Palestinian Authority. But as most people, like we said, first come to Yerushalayim and tear Kriya from that, so that exempts them from the other cities of Yudah. So they would no longer have to tear Kriya anyway. And in addition, he expresses concern for the prohibition of Bal Tashchit, destroying one's garments. In general, the poskim, you have the famous Pitchei Tshuva in the Yoredeya, the Laws of Mourning, who addresses this issue. We don't want to just rend a garment unnecessarily. That's a violation of Bal Tashchit, of destroying one's property. Okay? But it's fascinating that following the Oslo Accords, a number of contemporary poskim felt there's no longer Jewish sovereignty in Area A. It's under full administrative authority of the Palestinian Authority, and therefore one has to rend once again. It's incredible, again, how the political reality informs and shapes the halacha here. Okay. Now, while Area A is indeed under the Palestinian Authority's administration, but nevertheless, as you know, the IDF is allowed to enter to carry out certain military operations. You know, Chas v'Shalom, they need to look for a terrorist. So they go into Hebron, they go into Beit Lechem, they go into these villages and places that are part of Area A. Okay, so Rav Aviner makes a distinction between autonomy and sovereignty and suggests that, yes, while the Palestinian Authority may have autonomy over Area A, they don't really have sovereignty in the form of statehood, right? So, therefore, according to Rav Aviner, one is not obligated formally to rend post-Oslo, okay, when he sees Area A, let's say, when he sees the Arei Yehuda there, like Beit Lechem in a state of Churban. But according to Rav Aviner, he may do so if he wishes. It's permitted. So it's not considered a violation of Bal Tashchit, of wasting one's garment. And similarly, Rav Lichtenstein Zatzal ruled that while one is not obligated, he may do so as an expression of pain and anguish. Interesting, following the disengagement, or really in advance of the disengagement, contemporary poskim discussed and debated whether one should rend their garment when seeing these cities in Gush Katif now in the hands of Palestinian Authority, or Hamas really now, right? They voted Hamas into power. So, all of a sudden you have a lack of Jewish sovereignty there as well. So there's an interesting discussion, we're already out of time, among the poskim, whether the Gaza Strip is considered part of the Arei Yehuda or not. Fascinating. We already mentioned this morning the Kaftor Vaferach, this fascinating work on the geography and borders of Israel and the laws of the land by Ishtori Aparchi. So according to him, actually, the cities in the Gaza Strip are part of Arei Yehuda. So there's a whole discussion among the poskim, and some said you should tear Kriya. Some say, well, you know, it doesn't really matter because as we saw in that Braita that we began with, when one hears Shmuot Ra'ot, one hears exceptionally bad news, devastating news, one should rend their garment anyway. So some say that one should rend their garment upon hearing about the disengagement, even witnessing it on TV. Rav Aviner ruled that even one witnessing the disengagement on TV should rend his garment. Okay, and make a bracha of Dayan Ha'emet b'shem uv'malchut as an expression again of the tremendous pain. Al Shmuot Haraot. Okay, so whether or not the cities in the Gaza Strip are considered Arei Yehuda, just for the tremendous pain of the disengagement, there were poskim who said that one should rend their garment. We're out of time, but this discussion, this debate, really gives expression to this unique moment in history that we're living in. We've come so far, we've returned to our land. We've built a state in our ancestral homeland. We've witnessed the dramatic reclamation of Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount. Har Habayit Biyadenu, the famous battle cry of Mata Gur that is permanently etched, seared into the collective consciousness of the Jewish people. Right? Although, as we said, nowadays maybe you could punctuate that battle cry with a question mark. Har Habayit Biyadenu, is it really in our hands? We've come so far, yet there's so far to go. And this discussion of rending one's garment upon seeing the cities of Judah and Yerushalayim and the Temple Mount in a state of destruction really gives expression to this very conflict, this very tension, this unique moment in history that we're living in, how we mourn the Churban today in a rebuilt Yerushalayim. We'll see you all, Bezrat Hashem, next week. Take care.